Well, it's a great pleasure to be here and an honor to have such terrific commentators raising such interesting questions. I know I'm supposed to be quite brief. You've already suffered through 2 hours of me, so I won't be long now. But let me try to address a few of the points from each of these tremendously interesting comments. The first to John Forrester, who rightly points out that it's from the 1890s, from the time of Freud and Fliess, for example, to that Freud begins to think about censorship as a part of the dynamics that causes, for instance, deletions in our memories of dreams or experiences. And he points to, right away, to this Russian censorship. And it was why I wanted to show you what that looks like, which would have been a fairly common thing to have seen, to actually, he says to Fliess, have you ever seen these texts in which text has been eliminated, blacked out, or papier-mâché over? And I wanted to point to that because from the beginning, there is a political content to the censorship. And I don't mean at all to say that that begins either, that psychic censorship either begins in World War I or that it begins in its political sense in World War I. But rather that there's a gradual expansion of the concept of censorship from the moment in the 1890s where basically Freud is saying that we have in our memories something that sometimes from a dream or from a memory of events, that something seems delirious, but that same quality of delirium can be had by trying to read a text that's been excised. And in the 1900 interpretation of dreams, actually slightly altered in date so that it would come out in 1900 and have an epochal feel to it, but in the interpretation of dreams, Freud does develop the idea of censorship further and talks about issues of condensation and displacement and continues this Russian censorship model, but begins to extend it and to articulate the dynamical processes by which these transformations or distortions occur. What I think World War I does is to do a couple of things. One is there is an intensification and centralization of the concept of censorship, and that Freud is willing to follow out the censorship function not only as central, but to ask himself, how far can we follow the process of the political newspaper and postal censorship in pursuit of something that becomes, I think, increasingly a sustained metaphor and I think the way I would put this is to a later point of John's when he talks about structural metaphors. This is a good and useful term. And he says, we agree that censorship is a structural metaphor. I think what structural metaphor has two aspects, or I should say the censorship has two aspects. One is it's sustained. It's not a one-off. It doesn't just stand for a deletion, for example. It's begun to have the articulation that takes place already in the interpretation of dreams and in the subsequent arguments, but then it becomes something more than that, because it becomes in the war he's willing to pursue this through a more extensive investigation of pre-censorship, a more extensive spatialization of censorship as being a line, not just the ego as censor, but actually as a boundary. And I think that the censor in this sense contributes to the quasi-spatialization. I say quasi-spatialization because it's not metrically spatial, he says, for instance. Don't get confused. If we really tried to draw this in a proportional way, the id would be vastly bigger than its its content on this. So it's topological in that sense. But the topology is defined by a boundary or two boundaries that begins to define the censorship as boundaries creates the space in a topological sense. And so I think that the other aspect of censorship that's different from, say, the magic writing pad as a very useful tool to think about writing and memory with, is that the censorship has our affective response that Freud, this is why I wanted to go into such detail about the exchanges with Lou Andreas Salomé, is that he registers and she registers the fear, the doubt, the worry that we've done something to offend, that the affective content in response to the censorship is deepened beyond, say, a metaphor like the growing of a pearl or the aboriginal crowd of the unconscious and so on. That we actually, our response to the unknown censor, the substitutions we make, the fear of being discovered, the not knowing in what way we offended, are the body of affective responses to the real wartime censors. As the censors pry in detail into each of our exchanges, into the fear that Freud had when he stopped hearing from his son, into Lou Andreas Salomé's fear when she stopped knowing about her nephews and whether they had been shot, the sort of the terror that something had been delayed because something that they had done wrong, the rewriting of letters, that all of that joined the affective content of the encounter with the real censor and the affective aspects of the psychic censorship. And in that, so I think that a structural metaphor I would identify with a sustained metaphor, as the writing pad certainly is. What I think singles out the censorship is that it does these other things as well, and in particular pursues the identification of the affective content of our encounter with real postal censorship and our psychic censorship that goes in an affective way beyond what a sustained metaphor of memory might be. I thought it was very interesting what John Forrester said about art as a form of censorship, that art is a way of hiding. And one of the things that made me think of and understand in a new and better way because of John's comment is that the first thing that Sturg does when he announces the censorship rules and promulgates these edicts at the very opening of World War I is art is mentioned as in particularly dangerous. So it's as if the censor knows that the censorship of art, that art offers perhaps a way around censorship and the censor's focus on artistic productions right up front in one of the two clauses that launched the censorship regime. And I thought that was very interesting. The Foucault is clearly in back of a lot of what I'm concerned with here, even if it's not something that I addressed explicitly, and I think in two ways. One is that one of the things that joins the 1914-2014 structures is that they have these three features, which I tried to emphasize. One is that unlike the famous lobster slowly boiled in the pot that doesn't ever notice what trouble it's in, that the that censorship in 1914 and mass surveillance come upon us with enormous suddenness. Now, you could say in the halls of the intelligence agencies, it had been building from some time, from approximately late 1990s, then given a swift kick forward by September 11, 2001, but most importantly, revealed in its extent with the Snowden revelations in 2013. And so these two moments of end of July, beginning of August 1914, and June, July 2013 have a suddenness to them that is a jolt. The second thing is that they're ubiquitous. Unlike the other previous censorships, which became matters of quite some discussion, of the censorship of artworks, posters, plays, censorship, as Simon has shown us so wonderfully, especially in their illustrated form, how concerned this was, and you can see that powerfully in those images that he presented. But here, there was a way in which it pried all the way down. It pried into my daily newspapers. And Freud, as I mentioned, was reading four newspapers completely every day, the Neue Freie Presse, the Vossische Zeitung, the Krakauer Zeitung, and so on. And then he clearly liked the illustrated journals like the Leipziger Illustrierte Zeitung and others. So he that, and then he kept these detailed notes about the letters sent and received. It was for him a kind of all-encompassing out from his sense of isolation. And the lack of ability to travel, the lack of people to be with him, it was everything to him. It was his family, it was his work, and it was the building of a movement. And so I think that sense, but not just for Freud or Lou Andreas Salomé or Carl Abraham, not just for Sandor Ferenczi, not just for the people or Ernest Jones, it really was something that ordinary people experienced. And that sense of the ubiquity of it was something that was the second element that was really felt in World War I and in this more recent period. And the third is that it was intimate. It got at, there's something about, you know, finding out that GCHQ was monitoring a lot of Skype and video Skype, and they were it came out that they were, a lot of the video Skypes were people sending video of themselves naked or sex or having sex. They were doing intimate things. And I think part of the shock was that it really, there was no limit. It just felt like there was no stopping. And I think that intimacy, that prying, that putting a barrier between Freud and his sons, or Freud and his daughter, or Freud and his friends that he counted on so much, like Andreas Salomé and Jones and the other wartime correspondents, was something that really got to him. So it's those three things together that I think gave an intensity to it. And by the end of the war, people like Jones and even people like Rivers, who didn't like much what Freud had done with importing this social censor into the endopsychic censor, to use Jones's language, but both of them saw this as central to Freud. I don't think... By the time you get to censorship in the interpretation of dreams, it plays an important role, but you have to pick it out. It doesn't start that way. And I think by the wartime lectures, it occupies, it's more pressingly central, it's given a new affect, it's extended radiatively to forms of pre-censorship. He follows, for instance, the Austrian press is censored at the last moment, and that's why it's whited out. What the Germans do is they make you rewrite your article so that it looks like they haven't left their footprint, so there's no white spaces. And then Freud, you know, says there are cases like that where in the unconscious, where we actually knit things together to make it look like nothing's missing. It's not like the murmur of Hug Helmut's, the garrison dream that Hug Helmut reports. And he says, but there you look for the trace forensically, the slight blurring, the less certainty, the not quite heard. And so it's really learning to read and think about the newspapers, and learning to, he was reading some of the German newspapers like Vossische Zeitung, this is Berlin, as well as the Austrian ones like Arbeiter Zeitung, which are excised, you know, into white spaces. And I think there's just a pursuit of these things farther down in intensification, and it radiates out to structural understandings of what this is going on with psychic and postal newspaper censorship. There are other things. The comments I found fascinating about the Zuider Zee, and I mean the sense that the kind of re-literalization that kind of sensibility points to is exactly interesting to me, but I want to turn to the other two very rich sets of comments. Simon is absolutely right that I think one of the characteristics of something that's concerned me through all of my work has been this moment of, I mean, Freud says that jokes often function by showing that highfalutin abstractions often are watered down versions of something very concrete. And He says that often is very funny. And I think so too, but funny it seems to me there's a kind of philosophical joke. I mean, I suppose I shouldn't advertise my work as one big joke, but I think that there's a way in which it is. It's about looking at this relationship between abstraction and concreteness, and in particular passing in the reverse sense, not seeing the triumph of abstraction after a kind of Platonic progression from specific to less specific to medium specific to a Platonic ideal, but saying, let's look at the abstraction and see what the practices are there when Poincaré is talking about telegraph operators and how we should, in a philosophical journal, and how telegraph operators determine longitude, and this is really what we mean by simultaneity. We read that as a kind of hypothetical thought experiment, but Poincaré is in charge of the guys with the telegraphs in different countries sending messages back and forth. They're his friends from École Polytechnique. Some of them died high in the Andes and in mosquito-infested swampy areas. This is what there is a kernel of something very literal that then he's using and excavating from it something abstract. And a lot of my work, whether it's procedures that underlie our notion of objectivity or censorship, psychic and postal, over and over again, that is what interests me. The something, the messiness, the embodiment, the materiality of things that lie simultaneously in the abstract domain. I thought the letter is fantastic that Simon showed us of Kafka to Broad on the 25th of October, 1923. It's a fantastic document of it, just rich in so many ways. And I'd like, when we later, to hear more from Simon about how the many other ways one can read that. It would be really interesting to just dig into that one paragraph and push on it. The Turing, there is something about Turing and Wiener, Norbert Wiener and Alan Turing, that present a very interesting combination, and it read in concert with these discussions that we're having here, especially the automated marketing, analytic predictors, and so on, predictive analytics. That is this, that when Norbert Wiener wrote that intention was really nothing other than a goal-directed feedback system, people were shocked. How could you think that? One philosopher named Taylor said. But a lot of people felt that. It felt bizarre. But part of the experience of the war for thousands of people was, for instance, trying to outrun a self-guided torpedo in the Pacific. And these people came back thinking, feeling that that torpedo was trying to kill them. You could excuse them for that view because they turned right, the torpedo turned right, they turned left, the torpedo turned left, and they tried to shake it. And their lives were at stake. And they were also designing such weapons to use against the Japanese and the Germans. So these self-directed weapons formed a high-stakes version of something that lay behind what otherwise would have seemed like a completely outlandish experience. To the point after the war, someone said, do you really think that a thermostat has intention because it keeps adjusting the temperature up and down until it comes to 68.5 degrees? And he said, yes. And it was only over time gradually, this what seemed like an utterly bizarre view became more and more naturalized until in neural networks and in many other areas of cognitive science and related domains, people are used to the idea of circuit-based, not just metaphors, but circuits-based claims about mental processes. That doesn't seem like an outlandish deflation of a phenomenological experience, but sort of as the way science should proceed, the way we should carry on in our understanding of mental functions. Similarly with Turing, that at first it seems bizarre that a machine has intelligence when 30% of the judges can't distinguish between it and a human. At first that sounds ridiculous. Of course there must be something willful, phenomenological, desiring, intending about intelligence. And this seemed to deflate that in much the same way. I think this is what's going on with these predictive analytics. We have that same sense of bizarreness when we the computer tells us what books we might like, or where we might like to stay, or what we're likely to do next. You know, my telephone will say, it'll take you 7 minutes to get to the gym. And it just, there's something uncanny, in a strict sense of uncanny, about that. And those statistical aggregations of behaviors begin to feel like there's an intelligence, willful, something knowledgeable, something about that. And I think that these could be connected, the predictive analytics, the Turing intelligence, Norbert Wiener's intentions, they all become a sort of linked set of what we could react to at first as being a bizarre, inappropriate deflation of our true humanness to something just mechanical, or in the extended sense. But we become more used to it over time. And it's why I think that the fundamental distinction between a kind of ipse self or ipse identity and idem identity and a protected, encapsulated, isolated feeling of I, desire, is beginning to be eroded, because our desires, our intentions, our behaviors seem to be as anticipatable by correlative functions as they are by introspection. And that experience, as the uncanny becomes routinized, does do, I think, what Simon was saying, that the machines at a certain point, that we become more machine-like and the machines become more human-like in certain respects. In that sense, the making and the picturing seems fundamental. And one of the things, I mean, there's a Foucauldian move here, which says that there are technologies of the self, technologies, for instance, diary keeping, that change and help define a certain area of selfhood or a certain regime of selfhood. I think you could ask this question in both ways, and it's what I'm trying to do in a lot of my work now, which is to say, what do you have to presuppose about the self to even imagine certain technologies? And then once those technologies become ubiquitous, how do they train us up in certain ways? So what did Rorschach, for instance, have to believe to think that the blots were actually a mechanism for grasping not the strength of imagination, but actually our whole mode of perception? It radically changed this to make us into magic lanterns, projecting our inner world onto the outer surface. And he had to have a view about the unconscious. That's what made it different from, say, Binet's view about, or any tester's view in the late 19th century about the blots. They were simply used to say how strong the faculty of imagination was, the way you would measure how strong your calculative abilities or your memory abilities were. So the self, as it was understood, was a precondition or a condition of possibility for the technology to function the way Rorschach and his followers made it work. But then once it becomes ubiquitous, once it's administered tens of millions of times and it's used in forensics and it's used in job placement and it's used in a whole range of, you know, attempts to make differential diagnosis, other things, then at a certain point it becomes a kind of master metaphor, and it starts to teach us, so that President Obama can say, as he has on many occasions, I am a Rorschach, and expect a couple of hundred million Americans to have some idea what he's talking about. So I think the back and forth between self and technology is crucial, that, or in Simon's phrase, making and picturing, picturing and making. Richard Holden's comments I found equally compelling, and one of the things that I was particularly interested in was the way the will-based self and the unconscious-based self form the dyad across which he's thinking about many of these issues. A 17th century, 18th century picture of two modes of self-ignorance. And in a way, here's a place where from the sequence, I would say, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Foucault, I absolutely take on board the sense that there is a historicity to the self, that the self does, actually how we understand and experience the self, it does change over time. Where I disagree with that picture that we get often from Foucault in particular, who goes much farther in articulating these questions, is that Foucault tends to be epochal, that there tend to be regimes that change to other regimes. Now, he's not so interested in the mechanism of transition. Let's leave that aside for a moment. That's the historian's usual complaint about Foucault. I'm not so worried about that. What worries me is the idea that the older forms of reasoning, whether it's epistemological or otherwise, or the partition of the world into different ontologies, that these change of a piece, the kind of insight that so grabbed others, including Thomas Kuhn. What seems to me more likely the case, what I see more looking at this as a kind of philosophical history, is actually something that makes possible, it's in some ways, a thought like the one that Richard is pointing to us, namely that these two pictures of a will-based self and an unconscious-based self, where the will is sort of bypassed in some way. I mean, Freud doesn't have much truck with a will. It doesn't actually enter as a primary category. And there's no place that the will occurs in the topographic diagram, for example. The will, if I had to guess, John probably has a better answer than this, but the will seems too thoroughly saturated with the conscious, and therefore is too restricted and localized to occupy the place that it had in the late 17th, 18th century, where a will-based psychology became so dominant. But what I think we clearly have in the way we understand ourselves, sometimes we do think of ourselves as willing or a will to will, and that this becomes, we recognize a will-based self. And so it seems to me that we, in fact, it's more like a layering where the will, and we talk about parapraxis, it's quite ordinary, oh, I forgot my books at so-and-so's house. We've absorbed so much of Freud's views about the unconscious that sometimes it doesn't even seem like it's Freud. It just feels like the air that we breathe. But we also still have moments where we use a will-based self. So I think it's of particular interest to look at the conflict in ways of not knowing. And it may be that we have both of those, and by turns, we don't know by willful blindness, and we don't know through unconscious repression. Two more brief remarks to Richard Holton's comments. One, he asks, how effective is our fragmentation? You know, when we sign up or we give a wrong telephone number, I mean, we're constantly asked for information. You know, you want to sign on for Boingo on the airplane and it asks you all this stuff. And, you know, I think a lot of people give fake information or, you know, my telephone number is 555-1212 with the Hollywood standard number. And, or we make up different things, or we put an error in our spelling of our names. To me, the issue is not so much whether it's effective. I actually think that in the medium term, the idea that all these strategies of deception are going to fool GCHQ or the NSA or the large target or the other large corporations is doomed to failure. But it's the impulse to try to use DuckDuckGo and Tor and pretty good privacy and the other mechanisms that have become so prevalent, used millions and millions of times a day, is saying something about the discomfort we feel with that sudden ubiquitous and intimate intervention. I thought that one of the last comments that Richard made is really interesting and troubling in a fascinating way. He says, if we have this experience of self-censorship, of not asking certain things online or not saying certain things, I mean, they're Chinese, I mean, I don't know nearly as much about the Chinese system as I do about American-British systems, but in China, there are all sorts of synonyms for Tiananmen Square, the date, number, there's certain numbers that will automatically cause your message to be deleted. And but at a certain point, you get used to the idea of not mentioning it, or maybe trying to mention it through some circumlocution, or maybe after a while you just stop talking about Tiananmen, coded or otherwise. That's the first possibility that Richard raises. Could we lose a desire to see certain things? Could we simply stop talking about something? And that seems to me very much something that I expect will happen. At the same time, he says, there's also a sense that we saw, I showed examples of over and over again in the time of Freud, where the white spots seemed like they announced their salience. What's so important that the censor censored here? And that it could actually become giant magnets pulling us towards them. And that wonderful letter to the censors who said, we actually, the British and the French, are starting to realize that they can read into the white spaces. They can actually infer what was deleted. That was a security concern mirroring many people's expectations that they could somehow interpret there. And that's what the Hughes-Helmut, you know, dream sort of stresses, is that the deletions become actually the most important thing. And Freud repeats that phrase, the best bit, over and over again. So I think both things can happen. Things can be both salient and forgotten. And as we know from Freud, maybe I illegally invoke him at this point, that perhaps opposites are actually alike. And with that, I want to thank the commentators and you.
Thank you very much to everybody. We have just a few minutes, and no more than that, if there are questions and interventions from the floor.
I just want to briefly raise a couple of questions that are normative, both about surveillance and about censorship. So on the censorship side, thank you. I'm noticing an interesting disanalogy between the political and the psychical, right? So for Freud, political censorship is just bad. The psychological isn't unequivocally bad, right? Civilization requires repression. We need to learn to sublimate the stuff that we repress. So is there a political equivalent of sublimation for Freud or for us? And on the surveillance side, I mean, I think we have some fundamental assumptions that self-knowledge is good. It's not so good when others really know about us. And it's probably good when I know about other people. Is it possible to build an ethic that's not based on such assumptions?
Should I? Yeah. I think there is a normative answer to both of those, but who is we when it's good? Who's it good for? I mean, the people who thought that censorship was good, like the brochure that Simon put up, the proud censors, and they thought they were maintaining the peace of the realm, ensuring victory at war, or trying to achieve the victory. And they attributed part of the success of Britain in World War I to the successful prosecution of censorship. So maintaining the peace, which continued as a goal in all these countries, in Germany, certainly Austria, England, and the United States, there was a kind of almost a further pushing of censorship in the post-war period, where a lot of the discontent from the war bubbled out into social protest or open revolt, as in the case of Bavaria. So, led to the Palmer raids and the ferocious crackdown on the American left in 1919. So, I think that it sort of depends who you ask. But there was a normative justification for. I mean, there are people who thought it really was a good thing: success in maintaining calm in society and victory at war. As far as surveillance goes, there we're more implicated, because the side that we take pleasure from, of having things suggested to us, of suggesting an address, a common route that we take, being able to make guesses that are these come out of these complicated correlation functions and LDA programs and so on, that we begin to appreciate them. And yes, you can remove all your cookies, as DuckDuckGo will do, and then actually it takes a lot more time, because it doesn't remember when you're signing up for something, what your address is. It doesn't prompt you in that same way. We become used to all of those affordances, hate that word, all of those affordances that these applications have built into them. We are complicit in our surveillance in the sense that we kind of like having these helpful reminders, these nudges, these slight pressures to remind us where we should go, who we're talking to, what our schedules might be, to correlate we make a flight reservation and it shows up and it suggests hotels near. I mean, it's all of those things that we become habituated to are exactly what makes possible the correlative, the analytic predictors that we then say, but we don't want them knowing all this about us. Well, we want it and we don't want it.
Hello, I'm Professor Langton from philosophy. I am fascinated to learn of the social censorship that was going on around Freud as he was developing his theory of psychic censorship. But for me, if you don't mind me saying, there's a bit of white paint in your story. And that's what's missing for me is the story about Freud's own censorship. And I'm thinking of his censorship of his own patients and maybe himself, though I'm not going to speculate about that. So we heard the story about the girl with the very amusing sexual symptoms, which he could decode and her mother couldn't. If Freud had been hearing that story in the late 1890s, he would have interpreted it, maybe, as a story of sexual abuse. It would have been, and here's a nice displacement for us, he would have called it the seduction theory. But he found it implausible to believe that sexual abuse was common. He found it more plausible to believe a theory of infantile sexuality that turned it all into censored fantasy. And so his own theory of psychic censorship was born out of a very mundane, ordinary censorship of depriving ordinary people of their credibility. And that's a kind of censorship that is still around us and at least as important as the sort that you have been describing.
I think that's true, and John Forrester probably in a better position to discuss this than I am, since he's written directly on the Freud wars that surrounded these issues. But I would actually go farther than what you've said, and say that when the standard edition, for instance, was published, there were sections that were deleted from the discussion of. For instance, of the Russian censor dream that had to do with the detailed reports of an attestation of child abuse. So then there was these battles over that Masson and others were involved with over what should be published and when it could be published, and then what relationship this had with the whole theory of transference that came out of Freud. So there's a very long story about that, and I think it's. Important to recognize that is another part of Freud's, the role that censorship plays within Freud surrounding these ideas. But maybe I'll ask John if he has further thoughts since you've written so importantly on this.
It was me that introduced the little anecdote. And it was from exactly the period you're describing. Freud didn't say anything about the infantile experience. This was a young girl. He calls her, I can't remember, he doesn't give her an age. It's a hallucination of a sexual act that he implies is what she's experiencing. What more do we need to say about it? We don't know what went on at the time. We don't know if her father or her brother was implicated in a sexual act with her. We can imagine. There are Freud scholars who say Freud made it all up. These stories are pure fiction. That's one. Yeah, it's Freud's fantasy, that he is a fiction writer. And Keynes said, even if Freud were a fiction writer, he would be just as persuasive as to human nature. So, but I think let's leave it there, shall we?
We probably better be stopping since we're running very, very close to being out of time. So can I once again thank all our three commentators, and in particular thank Peter for what has been a fantastic couple of days.
Thank you.